Warringah is not full of people who oppose marriage equality, oppose renewable energy, don't think climate change is real, and want the prayer said prior to every public gathering rather than an acknowledgement of country and paying respect to traditional owners. Tony Abbott is an example, I think, a personification of that distance between an elected representative and their electorate.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, my guest is Anthony Albanese, the Labor frontbencher, known, I'm sure, to many of my listeners. I've been wanting to get Albo into the studio for a number of weeks now to talk about some of the interesting reflections he's been making in various contributions over the last little bit about political life and the culture inside politics and also social media culture and the culture of political discourse in Australia. He's increasingly concerned, as am I, about people retreating into bubbles, people not engaging sufficiently with people of who have different views and trying to sort of reach some sort of centre ground or resolution of those views. He is quite concerned about it, as you'll hear over the conversation over the next little bit. Listen up. Anthony Albanese, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Catherine.
Now, you have been saying some very interesting things of late, not hugely well reported because it's hard to sometimes punctuate the various disasters that are occurring around the joint. But you have, over recent months, been saying some very interesting things about political culture. And you recently launched David Spears' small book on the Leadership Challenge, and you had some interesting reflections on what it's really like in the building in 2018. So let's start there. What is it like in this building in 2018?
Well, the first thing to say is that it's not the same as outside the building, in the suburbs or in the regional towns or in workplaces. It's a building that can be very isolated from outside, and the people within the building can be isolated from each other. So that whereas in Old Parliament House, where I worked for a little while, you'd run into ministers and indeed prime ministers in the corridor. If you're a staffer, you got to meet them literally in the dunny. Here, that doesn't happen. People can have their own small groups and have views therefore reinforced off each other, and it can lead to circumstances whereby I think both in the 2010 change from Rudd to Gillard or the 2018 change, I think the view of people outside was very different from the view inside Parliament House. And so that part of my view is that if Malcolm Turnbull could have got through that week, members of Parliament would have gone back to their electorates and people would have said to them, not universally because there's no homogenous view, but people would have gone, what the hell are you people doing? Replacing another elected prime minister. But people here felt as though there was no alternative but to finish it, get to a conclusion. And once you do that, then the advantage is always with the challenger rather than the incumbent. Because if the incumbent loses, then they disappear, in theory. Of course, we know in practice that isn't the case.
Never happens.
And whether people leave physically, as Malcolm Turnbull did, his presence is very much still felt in the building. Not the least of which is the fact that there's still a member for Wentworth. They're just not sitting on the government benches.
Exactly. So I'll delve into leadership with you a bit in a sec, but I want to just take you back to your observation about people being isolated in this building, because I think for people outside that building, that would seem a bit strange, because the building projects to the rest of the world as this sort of, you know, boarding school with a kind of collegiate, clubby culture. So people make assumptions that everybody's all over each other all the time. And I don't think that's right. But I can't really explain why politicians in 2018 are more isolated than they used to be. Can you tell me why?
Well, there's a few things. One is just the physical architecture of the building. People have their own offices. They have their own bathrooms. They have their own fridge, their own kitchens. They don't have to leave their own office unless the bells ring or for a division or for question time or to give a speech or to have meetings. But by and large, a lot of the meetings will be people coming to them also. So there are people who are pretty lonely, I think, in this building. There isn't a gathering place whereby people meet and have a drink after work. They can be very much isolated, I think, in the corridors of this building. I think also that the fact that there are TVs in the in the rooms means they can sit there and think that they can watch Parliament without leaving their desk. They can watch ABC 24 or Sky News and see what's going on, watch press conferences, all of that. So I think quite often it can reinforce a sense that people believe things to be true, which aren't necessarily the case.
Well, let's get into that, because I had a conversation with Craig Laundy recently around some of these issues, and he described a universe where politicians are sort of isolated in their offices, sort of bombarded by false signals, right? Yeah, you know, commentators, at least on the conservative side, right, the roster of Sky News at night have thoughts that are resonant for conservative MPs or MPs on the other side of the chamber, less so for you, Mob, I suspect. But that in essence, there is this sort of wall of noise between an elected parliamentarian at the moment and the voters and the outside world that further serves this isolation, which further serves the kind of crazy in the building. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and if they're looking at their smartphone or their iPad and looking at Twitter or any social media feed, chances are they're following people whom they agree with.
Yeah.
So that I thought last Saturday night, there I was sitting at home flicking between the two channels watching the Victorian state election results. And when Alan Jones came on to the Sky broadcast, he said, I think quite remarkably, that one of Matthew Guy's problems was that Matthew Guy hadn't gone on the Alan Jones show on TV to talk to whatever minuscule the audience would be, talk to essentially people who were liberal MPs and staffers. But he was genuine, I think, in his belief that that was a negative, that he wouldn't talk to Alan Jones and Peter Credlin. Now, I'd suggest to you that the people who are watching Alan Jones and Peter Credlin's show aren't swinging voters in marginal seats. Mm. But there's just no self-awareness there at all. And I think for some of the members, take issues like the attitude towards coal, for example. Mm. The idea that it was a good idea for Scott Morrison to come into Parliament with a lump of coal is quite bizarre in 2018. The fact that so many of the coalition seats, particularly in regional Australia, voted yes to marriage equality, much to the shock of some of their elected representatives. You know, you look at the outcome in Wentworth, and you look at the future outcome that is coming down the track in Warringah, like a neon light flashing that Warringah is not full of people who oppose marriage equality, oppose renewable energy, don't think climate change is real, and want the prayer said prior to every public gathering rather than an acknowledgement of country and paying respect to traditional owners. Tony Abbott is an example, I think, a personification of that distance between an elected representative and their electorate.
So two things we've identified, right? Both really interesting. We've identified this sort of bubble effect that you've described of some politicians listening to media commentators who are not particularly connected to the outside world but are nonetheless sort of spinning inside this strange wheel, right? But then, so there's that phenomenon, right? Why are people more isolated? Why are they more prone to doing crazy things? That's one element of it, right? Then there's another element, though, that I want to ask you about, which is the sort of cumulative effect of the leadership changes themselves, right? We know that there's been this disruption that creates this strange echo chamber that people in politics now inhabit, right? But what is the cumulative effect on basic human psychology, right, of going through these very bitterly contested internal debates within political parties? Now, you were right in the centre of Labor's leadership changes over the 43rd Parliament, and you're still alive. Isn't that lovely? Still alive.
Indeed.
But you are very well placed to reflect on this, right? That I wonder whether the sense of isolation is somehow fed by people within the political parties no longer trusting their colleagues in a way that they, in a different way than existed before the leadership changes.
Well, there's an element of that where I think that is the case, and it's up to people to, I guess, change that culture, reform that culture, however you want to term it, through their own actions, by not acting in a non-collegiate way towards colleagues, and that's one element. The other element as well, I think, is we've spoken about the isolation in here, but there's that reflects in part, I think there's another element, that reflects in part what's going on outside the building, which is the increased polarisation that, that isn't just a phenomenon here in Australia. And that's, you know, one of the reasons for my John Button lecture and for talking about these issues, my Whitlam lecture, which lots of people commented on without bothering to read, and for various articles I've written, is I think we have to talk about these issues. The first thing to step to finding a solution is identifying
the problem.
A problem.
Yes.
And increasingly as well, outside, so many people will come up to me now, compared with 20 years ago when I was first elected, and it begins with the phrase, everyone thinks that. And that can be either of the right or the left. It can be a view whereby on marriage equality, for example, one of the debates that we had in the Labor Party was about whether there should be a conscience vote or not. Now, I took the view consistently over a long period of time that we should, that there was a need to respect different points of view. I have advocated for equality on the basis of sexuality since it was in my first speech, and I've done it consistently. But some people on the left were shocked that people in my electorate voted 80% yes on the electorate just next door, Barton, represented by Linda Burney, which has bits of Marrickville where I live in that seat, voted substantially no. And people in Grain Life, people I know, were surprised by that, because increasingly, I think, they hadn't had conversations with people who, for reasons of their faith, not bad people, not homophobic at all, but just viewed marriage as something that was a religious institution ordained by God and nothing to do with civil society or the government. Now, that perspective you can disagree with, and I do, but you've got to understand different people's points of view. And one of the problems with politics today is I think the solution isn't to talk through these issues and debate them. And I had a group of theologians from the Greek Orthodox Church. I had a two-hour discussion with them in my office about these issues 2 years ago about why I was a strong supporter of marriage equality. But if you don't ever have a discussion, you can't have an idea of where people are coming from.
But do you think people are having less of those discussions?
Oh, absolutely.
And why?
Because increasingly, one of the great benefits of the information age, and this podcast is part of it, is you have increasing amounts of, origin points for the information in which you consume.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you're not just people aren't just consumers of news; they're creators of news. They create views out there by tweeting, by engaging in a response to a podcast or to The Guardian online, posting a comment.
Sure.
But they can participate. But you can also choose what you don't
engage with, what you refuse to engage with.
And indeed, some algorithms in social media are designed to ask you to follow people essentially who you agree with, who you have some common interest with.
Yeah.
And if you don't like a particular point of view, you can block it even from if they want to communicate with you. So it reinforces people's views. And much of it as well, because of the pace of change. You know, we used to in this building, the wonderful Alan Ramsey would basically produce
two columns a week,
and they were on the same day.
Yeah.
The big column and then the side column.
Yeah.
On a Saturday, Sydney Morning Herald, it was the first thing, if you were interested in politics, you read on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. It was well researched. He talked to lots of people. It was incisive, and you had to read it.
And brutal sometimes.
Brutal, absolutely. but now people are posting instantaneously.
Mm.
And that can have an impact in terms of the leadership issues we were talking about. No journo wants to miss the scoop that there's a challenge on or that Craig Kelly's going to sit on the crossbench or that something else is going to happen. So it's written without confirmation, often without consultation.
Yeah.
You know, I often have from time to time now have things written no one's even bothered to pick up the phone. And, yeah, you mark those people down in terms of how seriously you take them as a journalist. But I understand the pressure that is on them to behave in that way. But it becomes quite often shorthand. So it's a short statement. And so people are also engaging in a similar way. One of the points that I've made in some of these discussions is that so many of what people would term policies aren't actually really that. They're slogans.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be, you know, stop the boats, stop, you know, energy prices going up, or stop Adani, stop WestConnex, stop, you know, fill in your topic of choice, not things like climate change, of course, require a response that can't be 280 characters.
Yeah.
It's a complex issue. The issue of dealing with asylum seekers is a complex issue. So much of what we have to deal with is about complexity and about dialogue and therefore about debate and refinement of your argument as well. You've got to be prepared to concede that maybe you don't know everything.
And what a shock.
That arising out of the dialogue comes productive change. And for a progressive as well, it seems to me, and I guess this is why I'm engaging in this debate, is that essentially what divides people, in my view, about where people stand on the political spectrum between the left and the right, is that if you're on the left of politics, you essentially have faith in humanity and you're positive and optimistic about the future. If you are much more and an acknowledgement that there is a common humanity, that the sum of everyone isn't just 1 + 1 = 2, that 1 + 1 actually equals 3, because there's a benefit in a collective approach. There is such a thing indeed as society. Now, if you have that faith in humanity, you should be prepared to engage in debate and to take your arguments forward. So I was criticised in the Rudd and Gillard governments for being the only minister who went on Andrew Bolt's program.
Yes.
Now, I when he was on commercial TV on a Sunday, now I had a view and still have a view that talking with someone doesn't mean you agree with them. In fact, it can be quite the opposite. You can put your case, and it's not about talking to them when you're talking to the media. It's about talking to the people who are watching the TV program or the radio program or listening to the podcast. And that therefore, if you're confident of how change occurs and progressive change I see as a continuum, that society does move forward, doesn't move forward in a straight line, but if you look at any of the great social issues, for example, be it the rights of women, Indigenous people, same-sex relationships, all of these, it is impossible to argue we're not in a better place now than we were decades ago. There is an advance, and that quite often, sometimes people on the left, I think, romanticise the past. People will say to me, oh, the Labor Party's not what it used to be. Yeah, we don't support the White Australia policy anymore. You know, the history of the Labor Party has been winning debates on, take, for example, gay and lesbian reform. When I came into this parliament in my first term, I moved a private member's bill about superannuation entitlements for same-sex couples. What that did was open up a debate and a logic.
Yeah.
Once people accepted that people shouldn't be discriminated against for what was their money being given to their partner, then it enabled you to, once you got through that logical step, to then broaden it out into, well, what about immigration, health,
and other things,
social security, other issues.
But you're saying that it is important. It's an important component of winning those debates, to engage with people you don't agree with.
Absolutely. It's a critical component. And unless you're prepared to do that, to engage in that debate, then you essentially are just reinforcing the status quo. If everyone just talks to everyone who agrees with them right now, by definition, change won't occur.
Nothing happens.
Everyone will just stay where they are.
Yeah.
The truth is that on issues like marriage equality, people changed their mind. That's a good thing. And they changed their mind not because people yelled at them. They changed their mind because people of good conscience, particularly people in the LGBTI community, went and talked to them about their experience, about their life, that they accepted that heterosexual marriage wasn't going to be diminished by others getting access to the institution of marriage, that the institution of marriage, I think, has been strengthened by more people participating.
Now, you said a minute ago to be a, you know, to be a person on the left, to be a progressive person, you've got to be an optimist, right? You've got to sort of think that the human condition is, you know, that it's all going to be fine in the end, if not linear, right?
Yes.
That you get there in the end. Looking at politics at the moment on a scale of 1 to 10, how depressed are you?
I'm not depressed because I am an optimist. And I hope that I bring that forward. I hope that people who have a look at what I say and do see that. I think at the moment we are in a bit of a downside. I see the state of politics as being not particularly dignified with the revolving door of prime ministers. But at the same time, I see a lot to be positive about. I think that Labor deserves a lot of credit for putting out policies that are bold and ambitious on taxation, particularly an area whereby theory would say you should never put out tax changes from opposition unless it's we're going to cut income tax and you're going to get $5 or $10 more. That's
unless it's good news.
The only place that you should go.
But these bigger structural things that we've been talking about, right? Why people are sort of being herded into enclaves.
Yeah.
It's a bit hard. Well, I'm sorry. I find it a bit hard to be optimistic. Truth. Are you optimistic or?
No, I am. I am optimistic, but I think it will require people to break through it and to discuss what these issues are. And I see people in politics. I did a discussion with Craig Laundy about some of these issues. Mm. There's people across the spectrum who can come to similar conclusions from different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I think that has occurred. I think the idea of social media and being able to put forward your views in a way that is accessible has a real positive in that you can engage with more people than ever before directly and that there's many upsides to that as well. It's just when I do get, I guess, depressed, to use the term that you used, is when things like the opinion piece that was published on Tuesday, which led to this podcast, was of course published in The Australian. Now, The Australian is, along with The Fin, national broadsheet. I'm a bit old-fashioned. I like seeing things.
Yeah.
I like seeing things on paper.
You're a dead tree man. You are.
Yeah, I am. Mm. It's true. Mm. The fact that some people, when I posted it on social media as well, it's on Twitter, it's on Instagram, it's on Facebook, a lot of these shots was, I won't read this because it was in the Australian.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's precisely the attitude which depresses me.
Yes.
And why we should, what I was saying in the article. But, you know, we do have an opportunity to read information as well, you know, internationally. You can read The Guardian, not just what's happening here.
You can read the UK and the US and New York Times and
you can keep up with, you know, I have a great interest in British politics in particular and what's happening in Europe. You have access to so much information. It's a matter of, I think, we as humanity haven't quite learnt how to deal with all of that. And there's a whole range of issues. I don't want to go down that track, but the interference in the US elections, use of
fake news, and
all of that.
Yeah,
that is there, and you can have things that do depress you, that are very, you know, just completely wrong, and people won't see, you know, what the facts are, and even if they're corrected,
the mistruth persists.
That it's still there,
yeah, Yeah, no, shocker.
And that can be, that can make it very difficult. And there are times where, as well, because people will say things online that they would never say to you face to face, or even, you know, I sometimes, when I get emails from people, when you ring them up, someone who's been incredibly rude and abusive,
incandescently rude,
will
back right off. It happens
very
to,
polite.
Happens to journalists too.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah, I totally understand. Great conversation. Thank you for it. One more question. Just let's revisit leadership, which we've addressed through this conversation. Does the revolving door have to stop?
Of course it has to stop.
But then what? Okay, yes, I agree with you. But then what about people with legitimate aspirations to lead their political parties?
Sure. Look, you will have that, and parties will engage in, you know, debate about who should lead them from time to time. But what we had with the recent challenge was Malcolm Turnbull, who was on 49% of the two-party preferred vote, which if you look at every election there might be an exception, but I can't think of one. Every election that I've been involved in with, including 2007, the government came back towards the end of the election campaign period.
Yeah.
The exception is 2010, where we had an election with a prime minister who'd been
rapidly installed. Yes.
Yeah, and was on, you know, and Kevin Rudd, when he was removed, was on 52% of the two-party preferred vote.
Yeah.
But Malcolm Turnbull in 49 was a pretty strong position. He'd led in 58 news polls in a row as preferred prime minister.
And they necked him anyway.
And they necked him not for their first choice, who I think was Malcolm. The second choice was Dutton. The third choice was Bishop. And the fourth choice was Morrison. Just came up through out of this process it was just the Liberal Party room as well. So it's not even a majority of the parliament. I just think people look at that and shake their heads.
Sure, but in your own show too, because there are a number of people in Labor who have said to me, if we do go on and win the next federal election, we have got to be the ones to break this cycle.
Sure. But we've done, if you look at what we've done over the last, 5 years, we've been very stable. People have, I think, got on with the jobs that they have, you know, and I've certainly got on with my job. What I want to do is to be a minister in a Labor government. And I think that we have been stable. If you look at the people in key portfolios, so by and large have been there in their current portfolios for a long period of time. And part of the problem, I think, of the Abbott government was that they defined themselves by what they weren't. They weren't us. We have been defining ourselves, I think, increasingly by what we're for. Mm. And we have an agenda, you know, and certainly I think across the board, whether it's in education or TAFE or health or infrastructure, we will, I think, define ourselves by having a forward-looking agenda. And the government is increasingly looking as though, even on many of the basic things that aren't ideological, they're just not getting stuff done. And so I have people coming through my door all week, many of whom are about things that should be just bipartisan. The government can't achieve it. They're just incapable of moving forward. And I think that Scott Morrison's attempts to take hold of the debate have been seen for what they are. They've been pretty awkward and pretty orchestrated, you know, walking around wearing baseball caps and having a bus tour where he was on the plane, really, I think, just adds to people's cynicism. And one of the reasons why we've got to debate this so is the truth is that one in three Australians are saying that they won't vote Labor or Liberal.
Mm.
And you look at Daniel Andrews' government and the result on Saturday, whereby his primary vote was, you know, around about 43.
Yeah.
Above 57 of the two-party preferred vote, because he had a plan. He's implementing doing what he said he would do. He's been bold. You know, issues like safe injecting rooms are bold moves, voluntary euthanasia, a range of policies, infrastructure, doing something on public transport. He's building schools and hospitals. And he's telling people what he will do and then doing them.
Mm.
That's restoring faith. And he's winning votes off both the Liberals and the Greens by doing that. And I think that points to a way forward for Labor, but it also is a bit of a way forward, I think, for politics as well.
Let's end on that note. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for listening. We really do appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to Miles Martignoni, my producer, and to Hannah, who assists him in Sydney. Please, of course, the usual drill. My mind went blank for a minute, but it is the usual drill. Please do leave us a rating or a review. Very, very helpful. If you like the listening, subscribe to the series, share, tell your friends. It really does matter. Until we're together again, take care.